Hey, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk Splits. Splits are these bonus shows that we do here on Turned Out of Punk, where we bring back two people that have been on the show previously that may or may not know each other, and then we have another conversation about music. Today, two people that definitely know each other very, very well. They've toured together, but I don't think they've seen each other for a few years, so we definitely reunite them here today. Danko Jones and Chris Murphy from Sloan. That's right, two of my favorite front people, two Toronto music icons, even though Chris is originally from Halifax, but two Toronto music icons, and boy, do we have some fun. Before we get to that, though, and I'm really excited for you to hear this thing, Sloan has a new B-sides compilation that has just come out. This is volume two of the B-sides Win. This one covers 1998 to 2001, and if you are a Sloan fan, you know that some of their best songs are buried as B-sides. They are a band that puts out song after song of hits, and some of my favorite ones are these B-side songs. So you can pick that up now over there at sloanmusic.com. You'll also find upcoming show information and things like that. And speaking of show information, Chris Murphy from Sloan will be doing a solo show, Chris Murphy Gets High Park, where he will be going around High Park playing music. Spoiler, the dude's straight edge, so I guarantee he does not smoke weed. And if he does smoke weed and didn't call me for his edge break, well, this will be the last time he gets invited on Turned Out of Punk. But you can find out more information over at Sloan Dude on Instagram, at Sloan Dude on Instagram. I'm sure you can find out more information over here at sloanmusic.com. I would hope they'd have a link to it. I'm sure they would have it for there. But that is on October the 24th. Get your tickets now. Chris is going to be hilarious in that chat on this thing as well. And it starts at 5 p.m. But I think with these things, you can watch them a little bit later. Yeah, I don't know. It says right here. I'm reading the press release as I'm talking to you. It says here you'll be able to watch it till November the 1st. So from October 24th till November 1st, you buy this thing and then just watch it over and over and over again. Like maybe two or three times a day. You know, just get a good base coat in there. And also, my buddy Danko Jones has got a brand new record out called Power Trio. This thing is a monster. It is awesome. He is going to be going on tour with, well, he and the band Danko Jones will be going on tour. They'll be playing St. Catharines and all sorts of places around Southern Ontario, and Ontario, I guess, in general, in December, and then going over to Europe in the new year. You can find out more information over there at dankojones.com. Oh boy, this is a good one. There's definitely going to be some people that do not want to come on the show after this episode airs, but that's fine. That's fine. Sit back, relax, and enjoy Danko Jones and Chris Murphy on Turned Out of Punk Splits. All right. We are here on Turned Out of Punk Splits. This has been a long time coming. I'm here with two of the greatest front people of all time, two Canadian icons. I'm here with my friend, Chris Murphy.
Chris is number one. Chris is number one.
And returning to the show, my longtime co-host and compatriot from the Black Coffee Brigade, Danko Jones. So here we are. Welcome. Oh, I can't believe we're doing this. I've been talking about this for so long.
I don't want to shit all over your fanfare, but like, I don't consider myself a front person, but I guess for the context of this, I'm happy to hang with you guys. But anyway, sorry.
Who would be the
I
front
wanna
person?
Keep the excitement up. Kind of the front person, I suppose.
You're in the middle.
But yeah, I always have to play it. I'm always like, I want to say more. And I'm always, you know, I'm about to, you know, I try to say something and then Andrew counts in the song. Yeah, hey, how's everybody doing? Click, click, click.
That's happened to me too.
That's how you know you're a front person, when the rest of the band doesn't want you to talk anymore. Then right, you're the front person.
Right. Yeah.
So this is a thrill. I wanted to kind of find out, because I always associate you guys with each other, because I think, you know, you guys toured together a little bit, and you know, Danko, you're in the video, the Sloan video and stuff like that. But I've always wondered, how did you guys actually meet each other?
I would say that I first heard of you. Did I meet you before you were in the band? I first heard of you guys. I think Jay Ferguson saw you guys in some basement of some some house party or something, and he was like, "Holy shit, this band is unbelievable!" And he was following you, and we had, was it 97?
96.
96. Yeah. Your first record come out in like 2002. Like, what? Like, how did that? Why did you wait so long? Anyway, we don't have to talk about that.
That's a saga. Yeah.
But like, I feel like we kind of felt like we knew about you guys kind of as you were starting to happen, and we had just sort of moved to town, and we kind of felt like we were really attached to our scene in Halifax, and went back to hardcore scene and everything in the 80s, and then we moved to Toronto, and then we lost all our context, and we didn't really have friends basically, so we kind of basically glommed onto you guys and the Snakes and these, you know, trying to like, we're cool too, right guys?
Well, you guys moved here. You guys played Shanghai, right? Like just after you moved here under like a fake name?
We played Shanghai, yeah. Dan Burke, I guess, put that show on. And I forget who all played. Maybe, did the Snakes play? Probably.
I don't know. You guys played under like, I can't remember the name, but I remember it being like a big thing.
Salon Selectives, we sometimes did that.
Yeah.
I saw that show.
Okay. Yeah, I remember.
I told Jay, and I didn't really mean it. I kicked myself after, but I did say to Jay, You guys didn't practice or something like that for the show. And I didn't realize it until Jay's reaction, how insensitive that was.
Well, you could have said it to me. That would roll off me. It would Jay probably remembers it to this day. So we thought, you know, we thought of ourselves as cool. We moved to Toronto, and we're like, who can we hang out with? Like we had some friends who moved up there, you know, the Thrushermit guys were kind of some of the guys who had moved up there, and the Super Friends kind of became the Flashing Lights, and we kind of hung out with those guys. And we had, did we have you guys on tour with us in, was it 97? Was it that early?
It was for Between the Bridges.
Okay, so 99. But
we opened for you for One Chord to Another.
Okay, so that's
the concert hall.
That's
which is 97.
Yeah, maybe even 96. Okay, 97. But I would say that we learned a lesson from you guys touring with us, which is never again. Like, you guys blew us away every time. So like from then on, we were like, we're only gonna have rinky dink acts who can barely play, could, you know, barely get through a set or
and then
we come out and kick ass, as opposed to like we're coming on and Danko's just played and everybody's exhausted and lying down on the ground.
Well, I remember this one show we played with you guys, and I think it was Andrew.
I was not happy about it. I was just like, this fucking sucks. You got like people were so fucking destroyed, but, and then we came out like, hi, everybody.
You guys killed. Everyone loved you.
Anyway,
after every show, there's like a crowd around Chris. He always plays it like this.
But this isn't, he's just not saying this now for your benefit. When I met Chris for kind of I met you a few times, but like when I think I really met you for like the final time when we actually kind of like started knowing each other.
You're talking to me?
Yeah. I met you
at a party.
It was after the party. It was when we were at South by Southwest.
Okay.
At that party that David Cross emceed. And did Aziz Ansari MC too?
Maybe so. I don't know. I wouldn't have even known who that was at the time, probably. I was a David Cross fan, though, for sure.
Yeah, because it was like there were two stages. It was at Red 7. So there was like one stage, and then there was this other stage. And we were on the other stage, and we played with Keith Morris, and you came out and moshed for us and stuff. Yeah, and you were like, oh, we're chatting, and I'm like, we got to play with you sometime. You're like, no, that's never going to happen. I learned my mistake from Danko Jones. We're never going to have anyone more high energy than us ever again.
Well, it's literally the lesson we learned. It's like, yeah, we should have these guys play, but no, I don't think so, because, you know, we basically, it has to be either some rinky-dink act. Actually, we don't tour with anybody anymore. We're like, it's, we kind of have this closed loop. You know, we just open for ourselves, and we do these long, boring shows because there's so many records, and we try to, yeah, we have a new record and we're going to play 10 new songs, boo. but we're just competing with ourselves because we have so many songs now. But
I think every band winds up competing with themselves. Like, even if you have like 3 7-inches, eventually you're competing with that first 7-inch, you know, like everyone's experienced that thing where you go to Europe and they're like, oh, you used to be way better. And that's like, what do you mean I used to be way better? And it just like, it cuts to your core because you know that you've changed, but like to hear someone articulate it to you, and it can, so it doesn't matter if you're like 3 records deep or 20 records deep.
Well, it's certainly the nature of a lot of punks and or like people who define themselves by records. You know, once somebody else discovers them, then you sort of like, oh, well, I have to go find something else. I can't, you know, everybody knows who Fucked Up is now. You know, that's whack.
I think it's also like you get so much of music like is like nostalgic attachment to it. You know, there's like stuff that I know is objectionably bad that I like because I heard it at a certain time in my life. And when I listen to it now, it brings me back there. Right. And so like, no matter what, you're competing with someone's nostalgia. It has nothing to do with what you're doing musically.
Are you trying to get Danko and me to talk about Kiss?
No, but let's get there.
I'm just kidding. I mean, they, you know, remain my favorite band. It's hard to top for me, but it's like, you know, I was into them from grade 2 to grade 5, like nothing else, but just Kiss the whole time. So it's hard. It's hard to, you know, it's actually funny. Do you know who Ken Sharp is, the writer?
Yeah.
Right. He writes about, you know, power pop and stuff, but he's written about Kiss. Have you read that Kiss book, that Ken Sharp book? Yeah. But so I've talked to him in the Sloan power pop context or whatever. But he was talking about, he was going on about how good, he was asking me kind of when I got off the Kiss train, which was about, I bought Dynasty in 1979, but I didn't buy the subsequent albums. And he was going on about how this other record called Unmasked. He was like, oh, it's power pop. It's so great. You got to listen to it. And I had literally never heard it. So 2 or 3 years ago, I put it on and it was interesting as someone who had never really heard it. I was like, I'm going to be listening to this.
It's amazing.
Kind of period specific. You know, I wonder if I'm going to like it. And I thought it was terrible.
Whoa.
But if I had heard it at the time, I'm sure it would be my favorite album.
It's really good. It's a really good album.
You think it's great? Like,
the look of frustration on you, Danko, with like that was mad.
So did you stay with them? Did you stay with them right to through everything?
No, I didn't. There's pockets where I got off the train and then I would go
back. And then you get back on. Okay.
Yeah, I go back and see what I missed. And then, I mean, you with Unmasked, I mean, it's not as if I didn't hear it when it came out, but I've recently grown an appreciation for Carnival of Souls, because I think that is a very underrated album now. Whereas before, I was just dismissing it outright.
I don't even know what that is.
That was the album that they made, the grunge album they made, and they canned it because they got back together for the reunion makeup tour, okay. And it was their grunge album on their non-makeup, their last non-makeup grunge album. They were trying to be like Alice.
Did it come out? Did it come out or not come out?
So it came out, you know, after they had reunited and all the hoopla, and they just kind of like threw it out there.
And they did action figures for it too, right? I know not they did Psycho Circus action figures, but yes, I they also did that one too or something. Or
they did two, well, that I know of, two different sets of Psycho Circus series of Psycho Circus with each member's what do you call it, spirit animal.
So yeah. Right.
The Peter Criss had like a some sort of panther or something.
Right.
You know, that kind of thing.
Keep going. What else? What did Ace have? Did I ever tell you the story about when I interviewed Paul Stanley? Did I tell you that story?
No.
So I was on Q107 with Hungry Dog, whatever his name was. and then he was like, you know, and he's on the air and he's like, remember next week, going to be talking to Paul Stanley of Kiss. He's going to be in town doing Phantom of the Opera. And I was like, okay. And then after we were off the air, I was like, I'm a huge Kiss fan. Like, is there any way that when you interview him, I can just come down and somehow watch or pretend I work here or something? And he said, and then he called me later. He said, I'm interviewing him at Tower Records at Queen and Young for Phantom of the Opera. Do you mind if I like take 3 minutes to tell the story?
Dude, this is what this show is built for.
Okay. I'm Team Paul. I love Paul's fan.
Paul was always my least favorite as a kid, and now I find him the most sympathetic for sure.
Oh yeah, absolutely. He's the best.
So then coincidentally, I went to see Bad Religion at the Cool House or the Warehouse or whatever it was called.
With Unwritten Law?
I don't know. It's like 99.
Oh, okay. It might've been, that would have been the next tour after.
Okay. Well, I went to see that. Well, and I met Brian Baker because I had met Brian Baker in 86 pretending to need an interview for a radio station, but just to going backstage like a jackass with a tape recorder and in Montreal, but when he was with Dag Nasty. And then and I have too many sub stories, and at which time he told me how into the David Lee Roth solo album he was, and I was just like, what? Like, aren't you punk? Am I allowed
no,
to?
No, that's what I like. That's the best, because it's Junkyard, right? Like,
yeah. When he was on the show, he was so honest about it. Every turn, he's like, I just wanted to find a successful band. I'm going to be honest with you. He nearly joined REM.
No.
Yeah, dude, it's in the Bad Religion book. He was up for the job as a touring guitarist in REM at the same time that he was up for the job in Bad Religion. And it went so far as that there was apparently a Michael Stipe, I want to say meeting, but maybe it was just a
action
phone
figure.
Call. No, with Ian MacKaye. And Ian MacKaye, Michael Stipe, action figure here, I'm saying it, phone call about whether or not Brian Baker would be a good fit for on. REM.
And Ian, did he endorse him?
Yeah, Ian said he would. It would be a great fit.
Wow.
Good. I don't know if it would have been a good fit. I think it worked out best for all parties involved in the end.
Well, anyway, so I met him in 86, which he wouldn't remember, nor would he remember meeting me in 99. But anyway, I was a big fan. But and so that night, so this is the night before I was to be part of this Paul Stanley interview for, because he was going to be, he was the lead in Phantom of the Opera, right?
Yeah.
And so he was going to have to be a lot more accessible than he had been in Kiss. Like, he was going to have to do these like rinky dink interviews and stuff with like jackasses like me. So, but the night before, I was just driving by Tower Records on my bike, coming back from Cool House or whatever it's called. And there was a giant lineup of Kiss fans, like waiting overnight to meet Paul, like at Tower Records. And I went and hung out with them and was talking to them, and they were such nerds. It was insane. And then I ended up going out for a drink with them. They're like, we're going to like hold our spot. And like there was a woman, she had one leg and she was holding the spot for these other nerds. And I went for a drink with them, and they were all kind of taking me aside and telling me how their special relationship with them. It's like, I know so-and-so who's Gene's roadie. And he told me that, like, and there was a woman there. She's like, I slept with Bruce Kulick, and he told me that Paul's gay or whatever, like just whatever, just like craziest stuff. But the next day I went to the Tower Records. So I hung out with them, went the next day to Tower Records, didn't know how it was going to run. I was like, am I going to speak or am I going to be? So there was a stage set up with a giant, you know, 20 by 20 foot airbrushing of the Paul Stanley solo album for no reason. And he's supposed to, all he wants to do is talk about Phantom of the Opera, and all anyone wants to do is talk about Kiss. It was just like, it was a shame, it was a sin. So I got in there, Hungry Man, Coogan, Paul, and I are on the stage. I met Paul in a little elevator at the third floor, and he gave me a wet fish handshake. I was like, oh. He's not, he thinks I'm like a ironic, like, cause I was, you know, in a fucking golf jacket or I don't know what I was in. And I was like, I'm a big fan. And he probably just thought I was a smart ass, but it got off to a bad start because I said, listen, I was here last night and I met some people who have been in line for like, you know, 17 hours. I'm going to get one of them to ask a question first. Gus, where's Gus? Is he out there? Yeah. Do you have a question for Paul? And he's like, I guess so. Well, a lot of people know that Kiss tickets aren't selling very well, and is that why you're doing it? And I was like, oh my God. And so like Paul thinks that I'm setting him up to look like a dick. And so he's like totally like turning away from me. Like, and I was like, oh God. But the other, just a tiny bit more time, just the nerddom.
Take your time, dude. This is amazing.
Fans. They're like, hey, Paul. And he's always trying to turn it around to talk about Phantom of the Opera. It's like, Paul, a lot of people don't have a lot of things, nice things to say about Gene after the Kiss My Ass soundtrack or whatever of all these cover bands. And whatever happened to Angel? Like, whatever happened to the band Angel or whatever? Yeah. It's like, well, I don't know, but you know, the Phantom is playing. It's like, Paul, are we gonna be able to wear our own our Kiss shirts to the Phantoms? Like, well, yeah, but dress up, you know. Just like it was And I was making jokes that Paul was not liking. Well, a lot of people, maybe I didn't say this because I chickened out, because I said a couple things that was driving him nuts. What did I say? Oh, I was saying, like, one joke was like, a lot of people, I heard that they wanted Ace to do this, but he wouldn't do it. But then now they.
You didn't say that to him.
I think I did not. I don't have it all in order. I was ready to go with that, but I had pissed him off three times in a row. So I chickened out on that one. And I forget. I had other stories. I'll come back to it. I can't really remember.
But did you end up being friends with Paul?
No. There's nothing. Oh. He was not. He didn't seem smart. He was guarded and no fun. I kind of hoped that we would hit it off some way. I think we would more now, or I would be less freaked out. Anyway, I've read Paul's book and I've read all their books, but he seems sympathetic to me. He seems like a lovely guy.
Yeah, and he's always coming in and trying to save face for
James. Yeah, put out the fire of this asshole.
Yeah.
Yeah, the poor guy.
I think that Phantom thing, he was taking so much heat for it. You know, like, no one was happy about him doing that. Like, Kiss fans weren't.
Really? I just think, no,
I remember,
I know,
like, but people reviews were pretty harsh for his performance.
That's too bad.
Or maybe I'm thinking more Sebastian Bach, because didn't he do?
Oh, Jekyll and Hyde.
He did Jekyll and Hyde, too. He got really harsh criticism for that, too. It's a hard thing.
Did he play Jekyll or Hyde? I'm just kidding. But as Paul Stanley was doing it, and sometimes I felt like he was kind of reaching for notes and stuff, but I'm like, I put myself in his place. I was like, who else in the world could do this from the rock community? Like, it's like Freddie Mercury. Like, it's nobody.
Sebastian Bach.
Rob Halford could.
Sure. Okay. My point
Jeff,
being.
Jeff Tate could. I could do it.
You guys don't believe in me, but I could do it.
You could do it. It would be a little bit different. Anyway, sorry. In the end, he was so mad at me that I kissed his ass by saying, I think a lot of people here would like to see Paul, like an original recording of the cast with Paul as the lead. And everyone's like, yeah. Oh, no. I also said to him, it's like, has anybody ever, have you ever thought about like the idea of this Phantom and the idea of Kiss, like putting the mask on, taking the mask off, putting the mask back on? He's like, you're smarter than you think. You're smarter than you look, or whatever. Like he had to give it to me there. Anyway, I just felt so bad for the guy. Like the Kiss fans, I can talk about Kiss for a long time. I swear, I'll wrap it up. But
dude, there's no time limit. Don't worry. Just go. Like this is gold.
Well, don't you think? Do you think that? Do you think Kiss is blamed for the failure of the New York Dolls? Discuss.
Well, is it? No, it's Aerosmith. They talk about in Please Kill Me. There's like this scene when it's, I think it's Johnny Thunder's funeral. And someone takes Stephen Perry aside, or Steven Tyler aside, sorry. Not Joe Perry.
Steve
right,
Perry again.
Steve Perry. I love Steve Perry.
From Journey.
But Steven Tyler like is really upset, and he's like, and he freaks out at him about it or something. I don't know. There's a scene with Aerosmith at the funeral of Johnny Thunders in the end of Please Kill Me.
Really?
Yeah, I got to reread that book at some point.
I can't remember that part. Yeah. But I know people compare Joe Perry to Johnny Thunders a lot. So, sorry.
I always think Joe Perry looks like Tommy Thayer. Do you know the editors of Please Kill Me, like the book?
Legs McNeil.
And
yes. Do you know the woman?
What's her face? Yeah, I follow her on Instagram, and I can't remember her name right now. But yes.
It's Gillian McCain.
That's right.
And she's a McCain, like from the McCain's, like McCain's Fries. In like her name on Instagram is like GM Fries or something like that.
But, GMC
But anyway, she's lovely, and she went to university in Halifax, so she passed through there, and she dated Scott Kendall, who was in the Jellyfish Babies, who were Sloan's biggest, influence. Like they were the coolest band from like 85 to 87 in Halifax, kind of thing. But when she dated Scott during that time, she was going to Dalhousie or King's at that time. And going to shows and stuff. And I've been in touch with her. I've known her peripherally. I know that she wrote an old article from like Nerve magazine or something like I forget what it was, but like she wrote a review of the first Sloan album, and of course all she wanted to say in the article was that we came from a long line. You know, they were not the first band. There was like Dog Food and the Jellyfish Babies and all these things, to which I would agree or be the first to admit. But I've been in touch with her somewhat on Instagram in the past year, and we just realizing that we were at, you know, were you at that show at Center for Art Tapes where the Jellyfish Babies played and whatever? Like, it was just, it's interesting that we were in the same place in 85. We didn't really know each other, but.
It's crazy how many people were in that place in 85, right? There's obviously all you guys and the whole scene that kind of comes out of your scene, but she's there. Sarah McLachlan's there.
Yeah.
It's like one of those, I don't know. I'm like really fascinated by that, but from doing the podcast, like there's this high school in Seattle and El Duce was there. Nikki Sixx was there. The Screamers were there. Sir Mix-a-Lot was there. Like all these people came out of this like one high school, but it's kind of like, you know, like a version of that with all you guys winding up doing stuff. Like it's like,
yeah, Belitsky was there. Mike Belitsky from the, who's in the Sadies.
Yep.
Yeah. He's from that time too.
Guilt Parade.
They played,
Oh no! Guilt Parade. Sorry, well,
Guilt Parade came like Jeff Beardall. Like Guilt Parade played in Halifax in April, 1986, and blew my mind. Like they were so good.
Wasn't Dallas good in Guilt Parade for a while?
No, Sean was
not then. But Sean was.
I've seen Guilt Parade with Dallas.
Oh, I think maybe because they moved to Toronto in the end.
They were like Satanatras after that.
Which was Dallas was in Satanatras.
Yeah, because Jeff was there with.
Rustin from Trigger Happy and stuff was, and Chronic Submission, I think, was in Satanatras for a while.
Oh.
Maybe I know I'm mistaken on that.
Bernie from the Stinkies was in the Satanatras, who had joined the Subhumans, I believe.
It's amazing how you know, just like
I had one more Satanatra that I could make up. How many people would you just name? 11?
Dude, that's what this show is. It's just naming people and naming records.
I'm just kidding.
I throw out Bernie's name because Bernie's like, for me, he's like an unsung, you know, Toronto music hero who moved to Vancouver. So Toronto people, not everyone knows, but when Bernie was around, I mean, Satan's Archenemy God, Worm King versus the Hygiene Squad. These are great bands. And he was in Satanatras and Stinkies.
So what the bands that you're mentioning, that of which I've never heard, what year is that? Like, when do you start going to shows?
Well, this is like late 90s, the bands that I...
Okay, so made. I was here, but just like head up my ass or whatever.
Well, Bernie and Dallas were like... They were a pair, you know. They were, I think Dallas was in Worm King versus the Hygiene Squad.
Okay. I don't know who that is. Maybe I know who Bernie is, like from to see him, but I don't know.
Bernie Pleskatch.
All right.
I'm sure you know him.
He's awesome. He's like rock and roll and rolled up in one guy. All he's awesome. I love Bernie. He's
amazing. He ended up in Vancouver?
Yeah. Yeah. He's in Vancouver now.
I can't wait till like, you know, cause you know, have you seen that book, Chris, that just came out? The Toronto Metal book that Derek Emerson just put out with a bunch of people.
Is it Eve of Darkness?
Yeah. Eve of Darkness. Sorry.
I have not. It's not the same as that hardcore book.
It's like the sequel.
Same group. Yeah. So I haven't seen the metal one. I have the hardcore one. But,
the metal one's incredible. I love the hardcore one, and obviously that music's much closer to my heart, but the metal one is, I think, even more impressive.
Yeah. Well, it was, I don't know if the metal one was pressed at the same place, but I have a buddy who runs like a print shop, called Flash Reproductions. Do you know that guy? His name is Rich Poppet. He's a cool guy. And they made the hardcore book there. Like one of the guys who works there.
Derek works there. Yeah.
Okay. That's that guy. Yeah. He works at Flash.
Derek used to be an MSI.
Rick. Right. Okay.
Back in the day and stuff. But I can't wait till they do a book about the era we're talking about, because I think there is a book there, and it would be really fascinating to kind of like, you know, have all these bands and have all the lineages kind of drawn out so you can see where all these different people went. Because it's, it's really the roots of like the can rock explosion internationally that eventually happens, you know, when Broken Social Scene and Feist and all these bands kind of blow up and yourselves going around, like it's all like Rivoli Scene. I guess Sloan was already huge by that point, but
I don't think we get to be in that book, but
you guys coming to Toronto was a big thing.
We'll have our own book.
Are you doing your own book?
No, but we've been sort of tappy pulling our career by doing reissues of our records and having 32 page books in each one, just on that, you know, telling a way longer story than needs to be told, but just sort of doing it for the fun of it, for the people who give a shit.
I tell you this all the
time. You guys know what I mean.
Yeah, but I tell you this all the time. Like, you guys are the only like cool band from that time that was popular.
Well, it's interesting you say that. I don't know how to, I don't mean to talk shit about it anyway. We were supposed to do a sort of like a 90s package tour this November. And it was with a tour that was already made. And the tour was Tea Party, Moist, Headstones, and Big Wreck. And then because of the pandemic, it got moved, and then Big Wreck couldn't do it anymore. And then they came to us and they said, will you be this fourth band? Now, in our minds, like, we've always thought those weren't our friends. Like, we met them sometimes, but like, you know, our friends were, you know, back
the
then
local rabbits.
Yeah, the local rabbits and like the Inbreds and the Super Friends and Thrush Hermit and whatever. Like, we were definitely way more goofball. I thought we were cooler and all that kind of stuff too. But anyway, we agreed to do that tour. And even though part of me was just like, you know, are we too cool to do this kind of thing? But like, when we announced it on the internet, and people were like, yeah, that sounds cool. I was like, shouldn't there be some kind of outrage?
Look, I think it's because you guys had like the Big Shiny Tunes fame too, right?
Like, well, that's what I mean. Like we were referring to it as the Big Shiny Tour.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
all of those bands, the thing is, like, the bands that we like to think that we were associated with, like, whether it's like Eric Strip and Hardship Post and Jail and, you know, all these bands, they never got the opportunities we got. Like, we got so much luckier that, you know, we got on Big Shiny Tunes. Like, things sold like 600,000 records or something. And you know, you just get, even just getting listed, it's like, yeah, it's Silverchair and Chili Peppers and Sloan and mm-hmm. Foo Fighters. It's like, it just makes you sound like you're this enormous thing.
Are you guys on one too? Sorry, didn't mean to cut you off.
Yeah, Danko, are you on one?
Oh, yeah, we're on one. I can't remember. I don't 14? Know which one. Yeah, I don't know, but we're on one of them.
If they kept it going, we would have been on one, but they just decided not to keep it going. That's the only reason.
Yeah, so we were on, I think we were on the first one and the third one. I think the second one was the one that was the one that sold like a million copies or something. But anyway, we benefited big time from that. Like, and you know, at the time we were like, should we do this? Is this cool? Like, I don't think we should do this. You know, look at the artwork.
That was the time. Everything that we did would have like a meeting of, is it cool? And will we be cool after we do it?
Exactly. Well, I have, you know,
obviously you're still having those meetings to this day.
We still are having those meetings, and you know, anyway,
we're not having those meetings.
But you guys, you two both, like, you get to do, you guys are about as cool as can be. And you're like playing like, you guys are international. You guys have the careers that I covet, which is what I always wanted. Maybe this doesn't describe you, but I think of you in these terms as like having a worldwide cult phenomenon instead of just a big band that can draw in Regina and Saskatoon. Sorry, big in Canada rather. And it's like, we can probably draw more in Regina and Saskatoon than you guys, but you guys get to go to Frankfurt or whatever.
I would gladly trade that, because then I would be able to tour with my weed and you know, I'd be able to tour just a lot, because like the border crossings are always the thing that stressed me out so much. And
well, I had a revelatory conversation with you, Damien, one time where we saw each other and you were saying you were off to wherever, Frankfurt literally, and I was on my way to Kingston, Ontario, and I was like, Jesus, I'd love to go to Frankfurt for once instead of going back to AJ's hangar or whatever shithole we're playing. And you were like, I wish I could just go to Kingston and come back with the same amount of money. Like, not to be money grubbing talk or whatever, but just like, I have to go across the world. Like, you just have to go 2 hours down the highway. Anyway, as a family guy, and especially, I also thought in the pandemic too, is like, if they shut down the world, like, you know, we'll be okay. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know what it would mean for you guys. You guys would both be kind of screwed.
Yeah, no, I think we definitely start focusing a lot more on, you know, we'd do a Canadian covers record, I think, first. Then okay. We'd start playing the game, you know, we'd be like, who do we need to be friends with at the Feldman Agency? We need to make this work now. No, but I think you're right. Like, it would be very different. I did think we'd do I really did want to do a Canadian tour. I still really want to do a cross Canada tour. We've only ever done it twice, and we've never done the Maritimes at all.
Right.
So I really feel like, have you done the Maritimes?
Chris has done it many
times. No, I know Chris has done it.
we did it in 2002. We played like, I think, three shows, but we just played with Big Wreck 2 weeks ago. So in Hamilton. So like, if that scenario happens, we won't be as successful as you guys, but we will be opening for you, as I've now found out, but we'll be opening for Big Wreck, you know.
Right. I want to, I would love to open for Big Wreck, because I would be like, did any of you guys like punk bands? And then when they said no, I'd be like, okay, well, I'll see you guys later. I'm going to go smoke weed in the dressing room.
I was looking forward to going on the Big Shiny tour, because I thought it would be kind of hilarious to hang out with those guys.
Yeah.
And I remember Sloan is such a closed loop. We don't tour with anybody. Like,
We played with you guys. It was Headstones. I think Matthew Good played later. And then we were talking to you guys afterwards back at the rehearsal place, I think.
Sorry, and where was this? Downtown?
This is some open air festival in Ontario somewhere. This is going back 20 years ago.
Like at Canada's Wonderland?
No. This Matthew Good, Headstones, you guys, us. Nelly Furtado played, but she had yet to put out an album. That's where I met her.
Yeah.
And then afterwards. Sorry,
like in Ottawa, maybe?
Oh, God. I don't know. Some Ontario.
Okay. Sorry.
I don't know. Some city in Ontario.
Let's get to the bottom of exactly where this was, because I think that's your point, right?
Is there an action figure tie-in?
Was it Sarnia?
No, but you said, and I think Matthew Good was headlining at the time. And you said back at the space, like when we saw you like a week later or something, you're like, yeah, you know what we do? We just go out, we play all the hits. Everybody just goes apeshit. And then we get off the stage and then they play. It's like, just blow them off the stage. You play like hit every song everybody knows. And then you like had this smirk on your face, like, yeah, we destroyed them.
But I think I was probably I think I was probably in silent pain at the time, which was just like, how could, because as like Matthew Good's ascendancy corresponded with us like reaching our ceiling or whatever, like I was just like, who is this guy, like singing all this like melodramatic bullshit, like what? And that was on the way up, and we were on the way down, like we like between the bridges was tanking. I was just like, what's going on? Like, anyway, in 99, I was definitely at the height of my frustration. Like, I've recast my feelings to be one of, I'm just happy to still be doing it. All of my talented friends have gone the wayside. You know, Matt Murphy is like the greatest musician, singer, songwriter, guitar player. You know, he's working at CBC. I mean, he's not unhappy, but like, to me,
it's a good gig.
I know, but I just mean, to me, he's just like certainly more of a gifted musician than me, but like I was just, you know, I was lucky to be what I have, and I don't mean to downplay my work and all that kind of stuff, but whatever. I just mean, in 99, I was pissed. I was just like, this is falling apart. Like, you know, we sold like 80,000 records in Canada in 96, 97, and then kind of came down a little bit to 70 in 98, and then like down to 26,000 in 99. I was like, I guess it's over. But, you know, a million things happened in there and all that shit. But anyway.
Yeah, the industry changed too, right?
Yeah.
Everything died. And like, I think that also corresponded with you kind of like being recognized in America as the cool Canadian band too. Like, it was definitely, for the longest time, you go to the States and it would be like, you know, oh, I know Bryan Adams. And they'd be like, oh, and I also like that band Sloan. And it was like, well, you meet Tom Sharpling and he likes Sloan, or you meet the guys from the Strokes and they like Sloan, or you meet the guys, you know, it's like Danko too. Like when, you know, I'm watching Danko's side stage in Australia and I'm standing beside like Duff McKagan, Chris Jericho, and like all these other rock dudes. Like it's like, you know, real recognizes real. And like the people, you know, if you're doing something,
you know where I was that night? I was in Peterborough.
Yeah, but you know, you could have gotten pizza. You could have, like, there's a lot of things you could have done that I would have loved to have done after the show that I couldn't do.
It's true. Hey, I'm a happy guy. I'm a lucky guy.
I definitely have had that tour though, where you're out on the road with the band that you're like handing off your crown to, or like the band that's like taking what you were doing, but to, like, to that next level where you're like, oh shit. Like, we did this tour with this band, the Gallows. And the first time we went to England, they opened for us at this crazy show. And they had a lot of hype at that show, but I thought, like, well, we came out and we did our thing. So, but then the next time we came back, we were opening for them and the venues were ginormous. Like, you know, at that time, like, not the biggest thing, obviously, but like 2,000 cap, 3,000 cap rooms. And still to this day, I've never experienced an excitement around that band like that we did on that tour. Like, even going out with, like, you know, huge bands afterwards, like, you don't feel that energy as like a band that's like, oh my God, this is happening. And it really felt like, holy shit, this band took what we were doing about having a crazy live show and an aggressive in your face front person and just blew me out of the water. And now they have taken this and they are going to become super famous with it.
Yeah. I don't know what our version of that is. I don't like to think it was Matthew Good.
I don't mean like, well, I think my band's, I don't think,
I'm just being a jerk. Cause in a way it was, you know what I mean? This is like, but,
I love that. This guy's melodramatic. What the hell's going on around here?
Well, I mean,
he was also into soccer too. So that was probably it.
I don't mean to speak ill of him.
You started it, Chris. I'm just picking it up. Yeah, I just figure if you start it, then I can just keep
Patrick.
Going.
Patrick had a good line. Matthew Good. We were hanging out with him one time in whatever 99, and we're out late at night, and Patrick's with us, and Patrick would be drinking. Patrick, by the way, has been sober for like almost 2 years. Like, he's doing really
well. Good. That's awesome.
But he's drinking a lot at the time. And Matthew Good puts his card down. He's like, this is on me, guys. Like, he's big, big man. And then Patrick's like, oh, fuck, now I can't drink as much as I want to. I have to fucking nurse this thing. So he's like nursing his beer. And then finally he's like, he tries to settle up the check. And Patrick's like, finally, we can get out of here, go to a different bar so I can really start pounding beers. And he's like, yeah, can I get the check? And also some hot water for my tea. Like, just like, I got to wait around for you to fucking steep your tea and like you're the bill. Like, I can't get any more liquor. And the other story is, sorry, since that didn't kill. Matthew Good was complaining because he said, I paid $50,000 tax this year, guys. Like, he's complaining to us. And this is in 99. And Patrick said, oh man, that's a lot. You got to fire your accountant, man. It's 100% tax.
I remember, who was your sound guy that used to do Sound of the Horseshoe? Super nice dude. I'm blanking on his name.
Is that Brendan?
Mark Crane?
Maybe long blonde hair, curly hair.
Mark Crane was our monitors guy, but he worked at the Horseshoe for a long time.
Maybe monitor guy then. Yeah. I remember him coming back from a tour that you guys did out west with them and telling stories where Matthew Good's like, you know, you can't have a bus on these small tours like this because it's like setting up a fucking autograph booth outside the show. Like, people just won't leave you alone. And then, like, he also said, like, one night, these stories have stuck with me so much hearing them backstage. Or one night he's like, said, you know, it's great going out there and giving these people something to live for in their lives, you know, just like a memory that they can carry with them for the rest of their lives.
Like, is there a version of that, but it's me, but I'm here and you can't say it?
No. Every time I told Danko, do you remember, have we talked about the very first time that we met?
Not to me. So please do.
Where I sent you the notes in the cafe in Toronto through the waiter. And so
this is me.
Yeah, it was you.
Yeah, right. Sorry, I thought you were talking about meeting him.
No, it's you and Jay sitting in the front of that cafe that took over for CFNY on Bloor Street.
Right.
Or that was there for a hot minute. You know?
And you were sending me the notes. What were the notes? Like,
they were like, yeah, they were like, hey, you know, like, hey, man, how's it going? Like, we're sitting in the back. It's cool that you guys have moved to Toronto. Like, I hear you guys are in a punk, because I was just getting into punk, right? And it's like, that's super cool. Anyway, what's up? And then you didn't write back for a minute because you guys were obviously busy. You're going through photo selects. So then we were like, you fucking rock stars. You like, you move here. You treat me like, you know, blah, blah. And we're like, give them this note unless they pass you another note to give back to us.
Right.
But the waiter still gave you that note. And then you guys wrote a letter or signed a picture and you wrote, suck me, Sloan. The picture.
Well, that's why we didn't meet anybody. No,
we were dicks. We were being terrible to you. So, you
but
know.
When was that in relation to that party? You know what I'm talking about? That party when we were
3 years, 4 years
was
before.
Was it Tyler Burke's house?
It was Tyler Burke. I don't think Tyler Burke was still living there. That's one of the best nights ever, man. That was so
fun.
That
was super fun. There was like a garage,
yep,
with a music setup and.
And I came out and started yelling out hardcore songs for you to do, and no one else knew them, but you knew all the songs. And then Jason,
was that at Steve Perry's place?
No, this was in the basement or backyard of Tyler's house. There was like a rehearsal setups back there.
Is Tyler and Steve, didn't they live together for a while? They were roommates.
Maybe, I think maybe that was when they lived at that loft just south of Queen Street where Tragedy played and that kid lit his face on fire.
Oh, no, I don't.
Well, that's a wild story. We'll get to that story next. But that show that night was so amazing, man. That was super fun. And Jason from Weaker Thans was there, and I think we did some songs together that night. I'm sure we did. And you told me you were going to give me your whole record collection. You're like, I got some records back at my parents' house. I'm going to bring them back for you. The whole record collection.
That never happened.
Yeah, that never happened, Chris.
I could give you a bunch of records.
I don't want you to give me any of your records. Now you got kids. You passed them to your kids.
Yeah, they
but
don't
you did
care,
say
man.
You did say to me.
I'll give you a couple. I'll give you my doubles.
I don't want your doubles. I feel terrible about guilting you into that. But that was a super fun night. I definitely, that was the night that we like hung out. But then again, we met for the third time. Danko, the first time I met you was at Flash and Crash on Bloor Street.
Oh, okay. That was different from what I was going to say. Yeah.
Well, we met again for real later on, but that was the first time I actually met you. I was like super scared of you. You know, as I've told you this before, you cast a very intimidating presence in the early press that you were putting out there. The sure. Bruce of Blue story, I didn't realize was
me and Bruce concocted that at a Harvey's.
I did not realize that was concocted. I thought it was a shoot. So it was freaky.
But the first time I met you really was at Lowlands Festival in Holland.
Holland Lowlands Festival.
And I was actually scared of you because I'd heard that you, you know, whatever the stage antics were. And but I remember I told you, I still have your records. I still have your records.
I was pretty scared that night too. I was in North Bay. Sorry, keep going.
That was the first night that you met the dudes from Down with Webster.
Who, me? You?
No, I'm talking to him, Chris.
That got signed. Is that where they're from? I don't know.
I don't know where they're from.
They got signed by Gene Simmons, I believe.
It all comes back to Kiss.
Universal Canada gave him a record label, right? That's what it was.
Yeah, I think
Gene
so.
Simmons, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was. You know, the guy that didn't know who Chrome were, didn't know that Chrome were a band and insisted that his son rename his band to Chrome was given a record label in the modern day. That was my favorite episode of the Gene Simmons reality TV show. And his son's like, I think there already is a band called Chrome, Dad. He's like, it doesn't matter.
I thought for sure that like with, so this is Nick Simmons you're talking about?
I guess that's his kid, right? Yeah. He's a very handsome kid.
That's right. And he's tall. And I just figured that they would bequeath these characters to them. Is that not what's going to happen?
No.
Because Paul's got like a hotshot guitar player son. And
he's great.
And, you know, Nick Simmons is a tall, good looking guy. Like, put him on bass. I think that that's what they're going to do. Like, they'll soak up all this money. And then they'll say, you know, it's no longer Gene Simmons. It's like demon star child. You know what I mean? Like, just replace everybody. Why not? Well,
I think they're going to do that, but I don't think they're going to do it with their kids. Apparently Nick was working with Marvel or DC, and he came up with this story for this comic series. And then he got tagged with plagiarism.
Oh.
So that's what I heard.
Did his
father sue him? Was it his father's idea? He's very litigious.
Doesn't matter, son. I've heard this story already before. Doesn't matter.
I don't think also as a kid of a famous person, you'd want that. Like, would your kids have any interest in taking over your bands? Like, not mine.
No. Well, how old are your respective oldest? How old is your...
He's 12.
12, yeah. Well, my oldest kid is 14. But maybe they should be the band. Make that band. What, like?
Yeah. Holden has no interest in it, unless it's a band in Minecraft. I don't think he's very interested in starting a band right now.
Yeah. Francisco, like, we have a little electronic drum set up in his room, but he doesn't use it. But he's really good. He has used it, and he can do anything.
Yeah. I imagine it's like, I don't know. I had no interest in kind of going in the same field my parents were in, just because it just, you know, doesn't appeal to me. And I think I've effectively scared my kids off from any hope of wanting to be in the music business whatsoever. Like, I think they've seen all the downsides of it very firsthand. So, I think they would, I'd be interested to talk to them in a couple of years and seeing what their thoughts would be on wanting to pursue that. But,
you know, it's funny. My kid does like music and stuff like that. And he's musical and plays instruments. And I always, when I'm telling my own story, I always steep it with how lucky I was. And I always want them to know that it's not lost on me how hard it is to do and how lucky I am. But I think that has backfired on me, where my kid thinks, well, if you were so lucky, I could be really good and it would never happen for me. It's like, so I basically like overdone it with the sort of luck talk.
Yeah, no, it's definitely hard. And I think, and I weirdly think now it's a lot easier for kids of people that are in bands than it was at another time. Like, I think you were judged a lot more harshly for being the child of someone that had done something.
Of Bob Dylan?
Yeah, like exactly, like in a field, like where it was like kind of like a burden. Right. Where now we live in such a celebrity-driven culture that everyone that's done something successful in a field almost becomes like some sort of royal family. Maybe not in punk, but I think in all other forms of culture, like... people love the idea of like, oh, this person's like a famous actor's kid, and they're amazing because they're their kid, or this musician's kid. So, yeah, maybe Kiss 2 would be successful with all their children.
I just figured that's the way it would go, but you're probably right. They probably don't want to do that.
I want to get that gig. I want to try out for that too. I'm going to get the Phantom gig. I'm going to get that gig, you know.
I was in Whistler one time, and I saw Nick Simmons in the restaurant, and I looked on AirDrop or whatever, just to see if I could find his phone to see if I wasn't sure it was him.
You sent him demos?
It said Nick Simmons, and I just wanted to say, like, basically, I worship, like, I'm sure he just, like, is so over it. But
think about that, Chris. Think about, like, you're relaxing, you're, like, on a vacation, all of a sudden your phone blew, a stranger is like, hey, dude, I'm a huge fan of your dad's band.
I know. It's so lame. And, you know, whatever.
That night when you were in Whistler, I was playing in Milan.
We got it. We should do a tour, all three of us, one time.
What's the currency in Italy again?
Euro.
Euro.
Right. I thought I'd have a funnier joke if I had like the lira or whatever it was. Anyway,
we should do a tour together and just call it Top That Asshole. And every night we just go out there and try and make the next person have to make the set super impossible. We've taken some bands on tour where I'm like, oh man, I feel so bad. Like, where you just know you're setting up this acoustic band for like a rough go every single night, where they're going out there for people that are not there for that, you know. And but also, that being said,
you've taken acoustic bands on tour with you.
We took Kurt Vile on one of his first tours, and and my God, you know,
he's done all right
in the end. You know, I think everyone that opens for us kind of winds up becoming way bigger than us in the end.
Slingshots into the stratosphere.
You want to surplan? You want to surpass fucked up? Open for them.
Right.
Yeah, that's that. We're like the London of rock, the new London. Yeah. You know, band London, right. Like everyone's right. In, been right. In their band. I mean, Billy Talent, Default, they've all opened for us. Default. I mean, there you go.
The Default?
The Default.
Wait, are you talking about the British punk band that put out a bunch of 7 inches in the... Oh,
no.
Shit. Okay.
Oh, God. No. I'm joking. I had a few other ones, but I cannot think of them right off the top of my head right now. But the first one that comes to mind is Billy Talent.
But yeah.
I know there's more that are like you know, way,
the first
way
the back. First band the first band that opened for us in Los Angeles was Weezer.
Whoa.
But I had so we were and they were signed to Geffen by the same guy that signed us. So we were signed by a kind of mailroom underling guy who was kind of in the like Geffen was so cool, but we came in through the sort of wrong stream. Like Gary Gersh had all the cool bands, Sonic Youth, that begat, like, you know, Teenage Fan Club and Nirvana and Hole and on down, Urge Overkill or whoever. But we came in through the Tom Zutaut school. Tom Zutaut signed Motley Crue to A&M, but at Geffen he signed Guns N' Roses and like Tesla, Junkhouse, I think, or Junkyard rather.
going right out of my head.
Is that from your Hamilton gig?
That's right. Yeah.
Dude, but that dude was in the Tom Wilson in the Florida Razorblades or for Razors, and that's like a punk band too. So it all comes back to punk. But anyway, go on, Chris.
Just that Tom Zutaut, Todd Sullivan was the name of the guy who signed Sloan. We were his first signing. He was just like a mailroom guy. Sloan did okay for our first record, and our second record was kind of going into the toilet as he assigned his second signing was Weezer, and they were basically about to, like, I was at Todd Sullivan's house begging for, you know, $2,000 to make a video for a song called People of the Sky in 1994. And he's like, oh, yeah, sure, go ahead. I want you to see this video called Buddy for a song called Buddy Holly. And I basically wept. I was just like, we're done. Like, these guys are so, this is so huge. We are a piece of shit, but sorry, but the first time we played down there, I was like being a jackass. Like we were like, just being taken around like jackasses. Like we were in San Francisco the day before, like river rafting, and I got completely sunstroked. I was like completely beet red and barfing with sunstroke. And just before we went on, like I was so, I shouldn't have gone on. And I could hear Weezer in the next room, all these harmonies, they were fantastic. And then we had to go on and I was like, I puked on the ground on the way to the stage. Like, and then it's like falling over. Like I must've looked like I was high for sure.
Yeah.
But we really blew it. We blew it at we had been signed, but this was our playing for the people. Geffen had come down and they also saw Weezer who were excellent, but I didn't even see them because I was unconscious basically. Anyway, we blew it. They factor into our story. We do not factor into their story. They don't know who I am, but I think of them all the time as their ascendancy, kind of with our falling into the garbage.
Do you ever do you know Joe Sib at all? The guy from Wax. Sorry? Do you know that guy Joe Sib who played in Wax?
No.
He played in Wax. He played in 22 Jacks afterwards. He started Side One Dummy Records.
Yeah,
he played in a band called Frontline back in the day that was kind of like the Factions junior little brother band for a while. Anyway, but he was on the show.
He was in Wax, Faction, and what was the other one?
Dax. He was in like a Faction little brother band, I mean. And then 22 Jacks.
They're all acts. Jacks, Wax, and Fax. Anyway, sorry.
Well, Faction he wasn't in. He was in Frontline. Sorry. Anyway. Give me too much information. I'm sorry. But anyway, his episode, he talks about how like Weezer would come to their shows all the time. Like Rivers would come to their show all the time when he was still a metalhead. And like, you know, like was like, that's how he got into this kind of music, was going to their shows. And he also, they were the guys that first worked with Spike Jonze, and Spike Jonze did all their first videos and like took their photos for their 7 inches. And they like kind of got the idea of like, oh, let's work with Spike Jonze on this thing. And it fucked him up. He had to go to therapy over it until he could hear. He couldn't listen to the Blue Album for years and years until he went to therapy, because it just was like, fuck, that could have been our shot type thing. Yeah. He talks about it on the show. It's like it fucked him up.
Well, I have a similar thing. I'm not as bitter about it, but like our joke in our band is like Weezer's Blue Album is that's what our second record should have been. And then Twice Removed should have been our third record. We kind of we moved too drastically and basically suffered the consequences. Had a huge commercial flop.
Well,
beloved commercial flop.
Yeah, exactly. Your record's fucking amazing, you know. And I love the Blue Album, but I prefer your record.
I think the Blue Album's great.
Yeah, that's kind of like their high watermark for me too.
Yeah,
and I find it interesting that they
are you talking about One Chord to Another? Sorry, but that's a great Blue Album too.
Yeah, thank you. But I know we're talking about the Weezer album. Yeah,
I think Weezer to me is fascinating because they're a band that I can't ever find a direct punk connection to. Like they don't really have, you know, they don't come from that world in the same way. Like kind of like Pixies kind of weirdly too.
Is it true? Do I remember correctly that Thurston Moore wrote a big piece about why they were terrible or something?
I remember reading an interview with Dave Smalley talking about why they were terrible and exclaimed, but I'm sure, I don't know, maybe Thurston did too. I got to read that if that's out there.
Why would Dave Smalley not like them?
Dave Smalley, they interviewed him in Exclaim, and it was for the second Down by Law record, or maybe the third Down by Law record. And he was talking about, I think they were asking about alternative music, being like, you know, being someone who came from like punk or something. Okay. And he's like, I like Nirvana. I like that stuff. I think you can hear, you know, the energy in that punk stuff. And then he just went off on why Weezer sucks. Like just super hard on Weezer. And I remember reading as a kid being like, oh, there's a difference. Like, and that was when I first knew that there was like, there's like this weird divide in the music world.
But also never mind another Blue Album.
Exactly. There's a lot of do a blue record. Like if you want to do it on a classic record, Blue Motif.
Well, or, and then our next record was called Navy Blues. In fact, Patrick was so mad that we were calling our record after our blue colored record, Navy Blues, that he only would refer to it as our current record. Like he would never call it by name. He was so mad. Sorry. For those who don't know. Yeah. So we had a record called One Chord to Another, which was blue. And then the next record was black and red and was called Navy Blues. And Patrick from my band was furious. Anyway, just some context there.
It's funny though, like how, you know, those moments where you look back on, you're like, fuck, maybe we should have done that. Or maybe I should have handled that a little bit differently. And my whole life could be different now. Like it could be different in a whole terrible other way, you know? So,
yeah.
So who knows? But I look back on our record after our most successful record and me wanting to make like a super introspective record about my mental health and inner turmoil with finding success in music, and no one wanted that. No. Yeah. Everyone's like, oh yeah, you follow your rock opera with this? Right, yeah, right. Good idea, dude. You know, but I'm like, you know, dying in the streets for this thing with the rest of the band as they're like, no, we should make this record instead. I'm like, no, it's gotta be like fucking this.
I'm gonna die on this hill.
I'm definitely.
I can't look at, just the fact that I'm still here and making, you know, Sloan is recording now. It would be our 13th full length record. And, you know, every commercial misstep and all those things, like none of it bothers me just because we're still here. Like, I think that you guys probably feel the same way. You don't grieve like things that you could have done or ways that you could have made it bigger. Like just the fact that we're all still here. Like, I think we are all lucky, you know.
I just wanted to point out that Matthew Good's most successful Canadian album is also Blue. So,
holy jeez, you are, and also that song "I'm Blue" da da dee da 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 dee da 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 dee da 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 is a huge hit,
huge,
massively popular record. And
sorry, you're saying sorry.
No, and I totally lost my train of thought there. No, I had this dude on this podcast.
No, I was getting maudlin about how we're all lucky to be here, and then you had to make that joke.
It was an observation.
No, but I had this dude on from
ill-timed.
The band. I had this dude from the band The Dogs on, not to be confused with That Dog from the DGC Rarities comp, your comp mates. But
they're more than just that. They had records.
They're a great band. Unbelievable band. Absolutely. And I love them. Actually, the last record
Steve McDonald's lady.
Yeah. And the last record I bought before the pandemic started was their first double 7-inch. That was the last time I was in a record store pre-pandemic. I've been in a couple record stores since now, but for the longest time I was like, man, this might be the last record I ever bought in a store.
Do you go to record shows and stuff like that?
Not as much anymore, but Danko goes.
Did you go to the one the other day that Jay went to?
I couldn't because I was at the, oh no, I had a family thing on the Sunday, but, right. I was all set to go. There's some of my records that were there.
I'm sorry, Damien, I cut you off unnecessarily.
No, I was, and, so this dude from the Dogs was on the show, and they, like, every step of their career, they were too early or just too late for every opportunity. So they're a Detroit rock band. They opened for the MC5, but it's kind of just at the tail end of that. So they actually opened for Bob Seger on the first Bob Seger solo tour and got kicked off for starting a riot on stage. So then they have to go to New York. So they go to New York and they play with Kiss at the show that Kiss gets signed at. But they're in New York and it's pre-punk. But the Ramones guys, when they're still kind of like, you know, in some glam bands and some other bands, are coming to their shows and seeing the way they're dressed and being like, oh, we could kind of do this thing too. And they're playing with the Dictators, you know. But then they leave New York because it's dead, and they go out to L.A. And they get to L.A. and it's pre-L.A. punk happening. And the first show they play in L.A. Is Van Halen and Quiet Riot. They're playing with Van Halen and Quiet Riot as they're just starting, right? Like, well, just kind of like getting going. And then the AC/DC, they open for AC/DC on AC/DC's very first show in America, which was in L.A. type thing. But they're like, L.A.'s kind of, they're too punk for that scene. And then punk kind of happens, and they're too rock for the punk scene. So they go over to England and they're playing with all the new wave of British heavy metal bands. Yeah, dude. And it's just like crazy. At every step, they're just like at the tail end of something and just not quite the right fit for everything. So I just look at the career I have and I'm like, I'm lucky. I'm so lucky. Like, I could be these guys where, you know, you're always perpetually, yeah, and you're fucking amazing. Their band's unbelievable, but they just never clicked to the point they ever got anything out other than 2 7-inches.
It sounds like, it's basically Forrest Gump. It's like, is Tom Hanks going to play that guy in the biopic?
Yeah. No, I'm. That's definitely an obsession on doing the show. Is people that just keep popping up in different scenes and like kind of disparate scenes where they're doing completely weird, unique things. I'm like fascinated by that. But they are the band to end all bands like that, and they're still playing today. You know, they played at the Bovine 3 years ago.
Right.
Wow.
To like 25 people. I was away on tour, but someone else I know was there and said, like, yeah, it was, you know, not packed by any stretch of the imagination, but they were still incredible. They were managed by John Sinclair, too, for a brief moment, you know, from the MC5 stuff. But anyway, I digress.
Were they doing like beats now, like EDM? Like they're just right on, like.
No, they're still doing the exact same sound.
Yeah, I don't think tattooing their faces.
Yeah. That'd be amazing. It's completely contemporary now. It's got
still
like,
going, still going. Yeah,
there's still one beat away.
I wonder what band's going to be the Beastie Boys of this era. You know, like a band that's just like going in the punk hardcore world and then just pulls like a complete left turn and jumps onto another genre and ends up becoming like very successful in that. Because you can kind of see it happening. I guess there's like a whole wave of musicians now that are hugely successful, kind of like doing, you know, this new type of music, whatever multi-genre music that it is. You know, man, we should all do it. You first. Who's gonna get the first face tattoo?
Face tattoo? Well, I have another. I don't have a good joke for that, but I have a little bummer thing where I can say that, like, I got Bell's palsy for my face. I should tattoo my face back up to prop so it looks right again. So Bell's palsy, for anyone who doesn't know, is like all the muscles in my one side of my face, my left side, like they were paralyzed. So I had this total like drooping candle face. It's still a little bit, when I laugh and stuff, especially, I'm a little bit out of the side of my mouth, but it's mostly, so this was in January. It takes months to kind of get better. And it's still, I still experience pain and stuff, like an aching in my face. But I'm, as it was happening, like I was spitting in the sink and I was realizing I can't spit. And I was like, oh fuck, my face is a melted candle. But I was waiting for my hand to go. I was waiting. I thought I was going to be having a stroke, that like my hand was going to get paralyzed, and it did not. So I'm lucky. And I don't mean to make light of Bell's palsy, because some people, cause I took a steroid right away. So like I was able to sort of heal for the most part. So my face was really screwy in January, February, March. And my wife, this is another long, boring story. Like,
it's not boring at all, man.
Going off the face tattoo. She was like, oh, you should post about this on Instagram. I was like, well, what if my face gets better in 2-3 months? And I'm going to wish that there wasn't this disgusting picture of me with melted candle face on the internet. And she's like, just do it. Doesn't matter. Like, if it gets better, like that'll be. Anyway, so she ended up posting this picture, and then it got picked up by the Canadian press. So it was like, now it's the most known picture of me that there is this picture of me with my face dead on one side. And so I'm buddies with Stephen Page, who had been in the Bare Naked Ladies. And I was complaining on this text thread with him. I was like, oh, this is the most known picture of me. And then he texted me back. And it's like, he sent me his mugshot picture. And he's like, this is the most known picture of me.
Yeah, I was going to say.
And then my joke on that was like, but you never look better than your mugshot. That's the best picture of you that there is.
Anyway. He seems, I don't really know him. He just a little bit on social media, but he seems super, super cool and super nice.
Yeah, he's hilarious. He's great. He's just like a music nerd fan and just loves pop music and is funny as hell on a text thread. Like, he's good for jokes. You got the yellow tape.
Got the yellow tape.
I met them. They came to Halifax in 1990, and I met them, and I was playing. They played at a thing like called the Coca Festival or something. It's basically like you play in front of like buyers who buy shows at colleges and stuff. And they were in town for that and kind of blew everyone's mind. Like, they were actually like a professional act. Like, everybody from Halifax was pretty amateur, but I was playing bass in a kind of roots rock band. I wasn't yet in Sloan. I was in a couple bands, but I was in this roots rock band that played shows and stuff. And I was in that band at the time when I met them, a band called Blackpool. But I've known them since 1990, kind of thing. And, you know, they've definitely taken lots of heat over the years for being pretty whack. And I don't completely disagree, they definitely had a great act, and they were funny and smart as hell.
They can write amazing songs too.
Yeah.
First time I met Stephen Page was with Chris Murphy in Halifax. And we had just played Halifax.
Is this true? Do I know this? Okay.
Well, you were there. Halifax Pop Explosion.
You might not remember, but you were there.
And Stephen Page came up to me and he's like, wow, great set, great set. And you were right there. And nobody was talking to you. It was just me and Stephen. And you kept going, I don't know this guy. I don't know this. He kept doing that. And all I was trying to do was say, thank you for liking the show, Stephen. And you were just trying to be
cooler than him.
Yeah. You're like, but you were busting on his band in front of me while the guy's complimenting our show. And I mean, I'm going to accept the compliment. I can't just laugh at the jokes you're doing because he's complimenting our band. And you've done that to me more than 3 or 4 times when there's another person. And there's the three of us. And you're not even, the last time it happened was at...
Whenever the last time was, will be the last. I'll never do it again. This sounds terrible. The person you're describing is awful.
The Danforth. You say that here, but you're going to do it. Okay. It was at the Danforth Music Hall. I won't even tell you who the person was.
Okay.
But he's a very, very well-known person in Canada. He fronts a big band. And he was asking me about this one person going like, is he a cool dude? Is he a cool dude? Like, and you were not part of the conversation. You were just leaning up against the wall going, yeah, right. He's a cool dude. Yeah, right. Yeah. You think he was just totally blowing my cover. I was just trying to be nice and just go, yeah, he's a total cool dude. And he goes, yeah, right. You think he's a cool dude.
Oh my God. I'm so sorry.
No, it's hilarious. It was hilarious. But when that happened, the last time that happened, I can't help but remember the first time it happened with Stephen Page.
I love Stephen. I'm so embarrassed.
Awesome. But Stephen does that to you too. Like I saw when the Bare Naked Ladies hosted the Junos, and then you were on TV, and then he did it back to you, going like, we're not as cool as these guys or something, right. Said something like that. So you guys have this thing going.
Stephen, the Bare Naked Ladies did a great thing on the Junos. They sang a song. They hosted the Junos in Newfoundland, and they were part, they did a whole rap, turned out a punk talking about the Bare Naked Ladies and rap. But
Bare Naked Ladies were going to do a record on Simon Harvey's Discussion Records. They were going to do a split with a death metal band from Montreal. And Simon told me this story for years, and I was like, yeah, whatever. Like, not true. But he went to high school with the red-haired bass player. And then I met the red-haired bass player when he was backing up Sarah Harmer when I was doing Q. And I was like, I got introduced to him. I'm like, hey, weird question. Did you go to high school with a guy named Simon Harvey, and were you going to do a Bare Naked Ladies record on his label? And he's like, yeah, that sounds very familiar, that thing. So yeah. But anyway, go back. Go on.
My sidebar joke about the Bare Naked Ladies when I'm talking about them, it's like, yeah, and then they made the children's record, their heaviest record. No, but when they were on the Junos, they were just doing this diss rap at the beginning, and the funniest line, I just died laughing. They say, we're gonna rate the bands from A to D. And the first band gets a great big C. So do I need to explain? I don't know where your listeners are. Great Big C is a band of kind of like traditional Newfoundland music. They're called Great Big C. Anyway, I guess I should save these jokes for off air.
No, these are. I'll tell you one thing. I'm not booking a lot of Canadian talent on this podcast in the near future after this episode. That's okay. Joey Shithead was just on recently, so I've got my, you know, between you guys and Joey Shithead, I've got all my Canadian favorite bands on right now. So
Steven's been on both of my podcasts. So
I never had him on. I want to have him on really badly. Like, he would be, I'm always interested. It's like, was he a punk? Because I could see them being into like Violent Femmes, and I consider Violent Femmes a punk band.
I think he was more into, do you know who that guy is, like, named Stephen Duffy? I think he was briefly in Duran Duran. But I think he's into like Orange Juice, like that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
like
I love that stuff. And that's punk to me, you know?
Yeah.
You know, like all that, what's
Tears
that label?
For Fears and stuff like that.
But what's that label that Orange Juice was on? I'm blanking. Postcard Records. All that Postcard Records stuff. Like I find, I don't know, that's what I find fascinating about like punk, is it just went so many weird places, and like all these people were kind of coming from very similar points at one time, you know, like the fact that all of us were in a Minor Threat, you know, and none of our bands sound the same, you know, and none of our bands sound like Minor Threat. You know, it shows that like this stuff is interesting to me, you know, and like how small some of this stuff is. Like, you know, you seeing Capital Stalin Nation in Montreal, you know, and that band being such a huge band for me, and the fact that I get to nerd out with you about it, Chris, is just like, you know, kind of cool. Like, it's mind blowing to me. Like, only like maybe like 500 people in the world knew who that band were at the time that I was talking to you about them, and like you're like, oh yeah, I saw them.
Right.
It's looking crazy.
Yeah. So, what to reiterate or to tell Danko, just to like my little story, is that I went to Montreal in '86. I think it must have been that trip. So, I'm from Halifax, as you know, or as you know, but not as everyone knows. But to see shows, I would either drive to Boston or Montreal. So I went to see the Descendants in Dag Nasty, and that same trip, I saw No Means No in 86, which blew my mind, And, but I also saw Capitalist Alienation, this band. Like, I didn't know anything about them. I just went, I was just there for the week. So I'd try to go to shows every night, but they were terrifying. They're French, right?
I believe they were. Yeah, absolutely.
I think they're singing in French. And it's a
I think some's
girl.
In English, some's in French too. Yeah, French, I think they had two French. Vocalists even, maybe.
I'm picturing a tiny girl singing.
Yeah, there definitely is one.
And everybody's like super punk, like Liberty Spikes and studs and like it was just super punk. And we were just like my friend was wearing deck shoes, and we were just like meeting, like going to the bathroom. Was like, should we get out of here? Like, we were terrified. We just thought like this shit was going to go down. We're going to get killed at this show, because it was in a big city, and it was like these, you know, punk. You know, there was like some instances. Actually, it hadn't even happened yet, but later, like, there were to be some kids come from Montreal. You know, the story being that there were these skinheads who came from Montreal to live in Halifax for a while because, like, you know, they were on the run from the law, and they caused all kinds of trouble, like smashing windows at shows and stuff. So we're just terrified of these big city punks, and like we're just like just normal dressed kids in this real sort of like seemingly really dogmatic punk place. Anyway, but I think the band they opened for, was it possible they're called Bad Results? Is that another band?
There might be a band called Bad Results. I don't think there's any records by Bad Results, but okay. Like, it sounds vaguely familiar. Like, the only thing I know about them is that 12-inch, the LP that came out, and just sort of stories I've picked up from you and just other stories I'd heard. But, like, we all know Montreal's been, like, always the punkest of cities, you know? Like, the bands and even the metal stuff that was coming out of there has always been, like, kind of gnarlier and punkier than, like, other stuff. Even Voivod, like, is like a band that was like that big. They're kind of like got like a punk feel to like the way they kind of carry themselves and like the vibe of the band, in a way that, like, I don't know, I'm trying to think who the equivalent a band would be in Toronto. What's the band from that documentary? I'm blanking on it. You would know. Lips is band.
Anvil.
Oh, right. Yeah.
You know,
I don't know if he meets your criteria or whatever, but do you know who I mean by Mark Gaudette, who played in Eric Strip and Elevator to Hell?
Yeah, absolutely.
There's somebody wrote a thesis one time that he essentially invented punk. Did we ever talk about this?
No, but I'm going to get the Purple Knights records out.
Well, the Purple Knights stuff was recorded in like 74 or something.
Yeah, yeah.
74.
Yeah, it's like
pre-Ramones.
It's pre-Ramones. I think there's like 74 is kind of where there's this like weird energy explosion that takes off all over the world, where you have these like bands kind of popping up, starting to do stuff. Because 74 is also when you have Teenage Head Start. You know, you also have like the Rock from the Tomb stuff. You have got stuff starting in New York. Obviously, that band, the Dogs, kind of moving around at that time too. 74, you've also got stuff kicking off in LA, and the Nerves would come out of, and all this sort of scene, Zola Rex and bands like that. And then Australia got the Saints and Radio Birdman starting. 74, 75 is such like an amazing period where just like all these kids simultaneously almost like wake up and are like, we got to take rock and roll back to what it was and strip it down and make it like street music again in some way.
I'm reminded of Mark Gaudette because his favorite band is Voivod, and his favorite drummer is Ian Paice from Deep Purple. Like, that's kind of like what he was into. But yeah, he made this like record. It's like a two-piece Purple Night. They recorded. I mean, they didn't make a record then, but their tape is from then. It's from 74, mm-hmm. and it's Moncton. Like, I remember always thinking like, I was always kind of intimidated to go to like to New York. I was like, what's here? Like, who am I going to impress in New York? These guys have seen everything. You know, let's go to Moncton, where they're wearing pots and pans on their heads, and they're just like, they're just inventing crazy. They're just crazy kids. Like, that's where I want to go. I want to meet those kids. I don't care about New York, but whatever.
Well, like, the Maritimes kind of beats everyone to the punch on a lot of stuff, you know, like in terms of punk music, like the Slime LP. Is one of the first, it is the first DIY Canadian LP to kind of come out. And, you know, obviously it's not all punk, but there's definitely punk songs on that record. And even like Schizoid, you know, Schizoid is the best New York hardcore band, not out of New York. You know, I think I love their record so much. And like, they kind of were like doing something different than anyone else was doing at the time.
I don't know if I talked to you last time about the fact that my buddy, Pat Owantia, he kind of turned me on to punk in grade seven. Or he played Bodies by the Sex Pistols at the grade seven Christmas party, like just after John Lennon was shot. I remember the same month, like I heard the Sex Pistols and John Lennon was shot. But he went on, he moved to Montreal and he joined that band called Scum. Do you remember that band?
Yeah.
Scum?
S-C-U-M. Yeah.
I don't think he was the original guy, but I think he was like the replacement singer. And so I don't know if he's on records or not, but he was a childhood friend of mine, and he ended up living in Japan and like teaching yoga and stuff like that.
It's funny that Scum record actually got licensed to England. So that's actually one of the few Canadian records that's available overseas from that time period. You know, the DFU stuff you could kind of get on import, but they actually had like a proper UK pressing. I think on Core Records, that was doing like a lot of that Chaos UK stuff and a lot of sort of the proto Napalm Death Earache kind of scene stuff. So it's interesting that stuff found an audience there. Like, I think it's more well known in parts of Europe sometimes in punk circles than it is in parts of Canada outside of Montreal. You know, I don't know. I love that record. That's the Scum record. I don't know if he's on it, but
yeah, I don't know either. Should look that up.
Well, this has been a ton of fun. I've had a blast doing this, and I don't want to keep you guys all night. But you know, anytime you guys want to come back and chat more, we can always.
Well, let's go through and talk about what the ID points would be. It'd be like the Paul Stanley bit. There's the Matthew Good bit. Divide it up into tracks.
I don't think we need to divide up into tracks. We just put it out as one form awesomeness. This has been like, you know, when you think something's going to be good in your mind and then you do it and you're like, yeah, it was just like I thought it was going to be, as opposed to a lot of times when you do things and it's not that way. This is definitely the latter.
Well, I would say of that thought that I think it was good too. I don't know if it's worth like a lot of hype, but I think we could do it every week for a year and it would still be good.
Oh, I think we could do it amazing. I would, anytime you got, we could do it as a once a month thing, because this is, yeah, there's a lot more to talk about we didn't get to.
Do you know who Tony Randall is? He played Felix on The Odd Couple.
Okay, yeah. Yes, I do.
Can I just talk about him for a while? No, I'm just kidding. But he would just be, he was like a go-to guest. Like if the guest canceled, if Tony Randall was on, it meant that somebody had canceled. And they're just like, so that's, I'll be your Tony Randall, or Danko and I'll be on anytime.
I'm actually supposed to be Tony Randall in a remake of The Odd Couple. And it's supposed to be me and Blaine Cartwright from National Pussy as Oscar.
Wow. I thought you were going to say, actually, I'm actually going to be overseas touring. You can do it while you sit on your ass in Ontario.
I got to play. I've played now three shows. So I feel like, I've gotten to get my feet a little wet again. And it feels very different and weird, but also very comforting at the same time. Like, and I know we're not at a place where it's normal yet by any stretch, but it definitely, you know, I have a new appreciation for going out there and getting to play live and touring again. I'm looking forward to touring anywhere, you know.
Yeah,
Ontario, Europe, wherever it is. I'm looking forward to kind of like getting out there and experiencing it all with like new fresh eyes, because my God, I was ungrateful at different times. Are you guys touring? Anything coming up?
All my touring went in the garbage. All my big shiny tour was gone. I think we have a couple of irons in the fire. And I've also done this in the past year. I've done these like solo shows from my house.
Yeah.
Like I've done a bit of that. Like I've never been interested in seeing that or doing that, but like I found myself, well, I guess I'm going to do this. And it's been fun. So it's been interesting for me. Like it's, you know, I'm a fan of bands and I never want to see people doing acoustic confessional. Like I don't care, but, hopefully I can be somewhat entertaining, but it's been fun.
I've always felt that you should do more like, you know, Danko and I have like a regular podcast. You've done podcast stuff, but I've always felt that you should do more of that kind of stuff.
Sloan have a podcast.
Yeah, Sloan have a podcast, but I mean like the Chris Murphy show. I always pitched a Chris Murphy show when I was at Much Music. I was always like,
yeah,
Chris Murphy talk show.
I think there was a time when, did I ever say or complain about the time that I was Santa on Much Music? That I did basically an hour of freestyling with no idea what to say for like an hour. Like that's how loose it was on Much Music. It's like,
yeah, it was
just talk for an hour as Santa. And I did it. I did all this prep. I shot all this stuff, like this, all this background stories. Like, yeah, I was a comedian, like all this like true Hollywood story. And then I was on for an hour. It was Alive at Much, an hour with me and Bradford Howe, if that tells you what year it was. And like, I was like, how should I answer these questions? So, like, just wing it. As Santa, completely dressed, so you couldn't tell it was me. I didn't get paid. It's like, why did I do that? Like, I
just, like, a promo, dude. It was a promo.
Didn't even know it was me. Nobody knew it was me.
I
had a beard on. Like, my eyes were like here. It was just so stupid. Anyway,
because Christine Lushu would just, you and her had like this psychological torture game going on for years with each other.
Oh, I went to a party. I'd go to a Christmas party every year with her, and she put that on DVD. She was playing that Santa Live at Much during the party, and everybody was just making fun of me.
She was the person that brought me and Danko to Much Music, and she would always be like coming up with like the torture gift to torture Chris with for this Christmas party they would do every year
at work. She was very, very funny. Anyway.
We actually had when I was at Much Music, I realized it at the time, but there was never going to be a more free, larger platform for me to have. Like, it was wild. Like, I would sit there, smoke a shit ton of weed at the vape bar, come up with a story idea that was like completely nuts. Like, it was like drama club, but they were filming it and putting it on national TV, you know, like it was especially towards the end. Because no one was watching, you could do whatever the fuck you wanted. Like, there was so much weird shit we got on there that just, like, there's so, no way we
should. I know you were trying to wrap it up, and I will let you, but
I didn't want to wrap up. I was giving you guys a mercy if you guys wanted to tap out.
Maybe we're on, maybe this is episode two. We'll just cut it. This is the beginning of episode two. There was a Much West, and then they ended up doing a Much East as well. And they were so, Mike Campbell, who ran that thing, was so desperate for content. Like, I basically got to be on it. I had a TV show. Like, I was on TV all the time. It's like, what can we do? Well, let's put the Super Friends. We'll get on a boat. And like, it's just so stupid. Like, it was great. Like, anyway.
It was cool. It was honestly, I look back at Moses Neimer, and obviously there's other things with Moses Neimer that I'm not as much a fan of, but like, he was a visionary. The way he saw media, like he pre-foretold where media was going, and the idea that it wasn't going bigger budget, it was going lower budget. And as everyone else was kind of like expanding, he was kind of looking at the fact that like people wanted to see themselves on TV, like Speaker's Corner, you know, or even like the new music, the way the new music was done as a TV show was very similar to like Pitchfork and things like that now, where it was very editorial, very political, like it's very progressive TV. And I looked at all the stuff that we were doing on Much Music now and look at the stuff that my kids watch on YouTube. And I'm like, holy shit, like this is Much Music VJ content in between episodes. But, you know, with young people like having fun and doing silly things that seem, you know, off the fly, but they're kind of a little premeditated sometimes, but it's still ultimately off the fly. Like that's the type of content we were making.
Well, if I see any of these young kids doing Santa, I'm going to say, oh, I was doing that in 2000.
you didn't dress up as Santa at our Christmas show the time you came and sang with us.
You
right?
did. Didn't
I
you?
Did. Yeah, yeah, I did. You took my hat though, because I've seen pictures of you wearing a hat.
Right.
At some point in that, when you came out and did those songs with us. That was super sick. That was the coolest.
But I had done Santa before that. You kind of stole my act in a few ways. Doesn't matter.
I think ultimately, like, we all stole like a lot of people's act, Chris. Like, I don't know if you can claim the whole Santa thing. I have to admit though, you probably had to pad it out a lot more than I did. Like, I didn't have to pad it out. So really, I was probably the better Santa.
The thing that I did, literally, like, there was an audience that they tried to wrangle. There was hardly any people there, but it was just like, Santa, what's it like? What's it like delivering presents? And then just like no prep. Like I just had to, and just terrible jokes. It was just like an hour of TV, and there were commercials. Like I'm sure the people who paid for ads were like, what the fuck is this?
Much Music one time did before, like a Much Music Video Awards when I was working there. They're like, hey, we got this thing hooked up with YouTube where they're going to start doing these YouTube live streams, and this is going to be one of the first ones. Can you do this thing for us? And I'm like, sure, because I'm like, I could pick and choose what I wanted to do at Much Music, and I always wanted to stay away from the award show because I had such a terrible time at it every time I went. And so they're like, okay, just do this pre-show thing for us. And it was 4 hours of just like going live. And they give me a break every hour. I go down to the bathroom, smoke weed in the bathroom. Smoke weed's a recurring theme on this thing. And then come up and be like, all right, here we are for another hour. Let's just fucking talk shit. And people would be like writing in, and like they were moderating the comments because I'm sure the comments were pretty harsh at different times, especially when I took my shirt off. But but it was like on YouTube's front page at one point, they're like, there's like 100,000 viewers right now. There's 200,000 viewers. And it was just like no script. I'm like, this is insane. Like they gave me this much rope to essentially bring Stay down loose. The whole company with if I wanted
exactly.
to.
Maybe you did.
There's no more Much Music. They That's got rid right. of the brand. I killed that. I held the wedge in my arm, like the wedge in my arms, like a baby as it died. You know, just like, yep, there goes my thing that my childhood.
Well, we love you for it.
Well, I love you guys for this. This has been a lot of fun.
Thank you.
And we'll do part two eventually.
Well, thanks for having me on and thinking of me and being nice to me. And goodbye.
Thanks Dave, do you want to say anything?
Yeah. I just realized I go to bed at 10 these days. So I've zoned out a bit.
Well, you, whatever time it is, that must mean it's 10 past 10 because you went to bed about 10 minutes ago.
Yeah.
It's 10:40. It's very late.
Yeah. I enjoyed it though. I look forward to doing it again with you guys.
Right on.
A lot of fun. Different topics maybe next time will be fun.
Good night.